Welcome to Behind the Bookshelves. My name is Richard Davis, and this Abe Books podcast is dedicated to telling the stories behind books and the people who love them. Today we have two guests, Brad and Jen Johnson, who are joining us from Covina in California on the outskirts of Los Angeles. Brad and Jen are a bookselling husband and wife team. They run Johnson Rare Books and Archives and also have a bricks and mortar bookshop in Covina. However, Brad and Jen are also the organizers of a new book fair that happens in LA very soon. Rare Books Los Angeles occurs on February the 1st and 2nd at the Pasadena Convention Center. More than 100 sellers will be offering rare books, prints, photos, and ephemera. Welcome, Brad and Jen. We will start with Brad on the line first of all, and we'll switch to Jen later on. So, Brad, welcome. My first question is, so you're about to go into the book fair business. Can you tell us a little about Rare Books LA?
Oh, thank you, Richard. Thanks for having us. Well, Rare Books LA is our first book fair, the first book fair that we're organizing after decades of exhibiting at book fairs all throughout the country. There was a production company here in Southern California that produced great regional book fairs for many years, and they decided to retire, and we saw the opportunity and the great need to continue to have regional book fairs, and so we formed a company called Rare Books LA, and we're really excited for our first fair. We've got great support from A Books and the Huntington Library and Los Angeles Times, among many others, and the show is now sold out with more than 120 exhibitors from all throughout the world.
So how will it be different to the California Antiquarian Book Fair, which occurs the following weekend?
Well, our guiding principle for this fair was to be really inclusive and to bring in a lot of trades that were allied with the book trade. In particular, we are working with members of the International Fine Print Dealers Association and a consortium of mostly Los Angeles-based specialists in classic photography. There's always been a lot of overlap between their fields and the book trade, and we thought it would be a great opportunity to bring everybody under one roof, and I think it'll be a benefit to everybody. Jen and I are very much involved with the ABA. I'm actually the organization's vice president, and Jen is the organizer of the ABAA fair when it is here in Southern California.
But you want really, I get a feeling that you're trying to expand the selection that a buyer could see. On your website, I was reading, you describe it as a rare book fair for the modern age, bringing together fine works on paper. So that phrase, fine works on paper, you're talking about art, photography, ephemera, those sort of materials. Is that correct?
Yes, all the above and more. Yes, maps, you know, we have specialists all over the, you know, so many different specialty areas will be represented at the fair. Everything from, you know, crime scene photos to, of course, fine prints and original art. And of course, we have many of the leading booksellers in the trade as well. It's going to be an amazing assemblage and display of materials.
Brad, can you give us a flavor of the type of sellers who will be exhibiting at the fair?
It's a really eclectic mix. We're excited to have some of the leading booksellers in the trade, like Peter Harrington from London and the William Reese Company from back east in Connecticut. There's also a lot of up-and-coming booksellers, like Lizzie Young, who just opened a little shop in Brooklyn specializing in culinary material. And we have a few youngsters from the West Coast, like Kate Midas and the Munster Company, who are exhibiting for the very first time. There's also, among the fine print and photography dealers, there's Roland Belgrave, a really leading UK photo specialist, and Michael Dawson, who is from the Dawson family, bookselling royalty here in Southern California. He has become one of the leading specialists in classic photography. And for those who collect ephemera, we've got people like Peter Luke, you know, who is one of those intrepid road warriors that manages to turn up just amazing paper time and time again.
So perhaps you can describe what it is like to be part of the antiquarian bookselling scene in Los Angeles. It's such a huge, sprawling city, and I know there are many dealers there, but what's it like? Is it very art-based? Is there a lot of influence from Hollywood? What do you see in your everyday job?
We are very spread out, and I think the tendency this day is to specialize in material, which has led to a lot of collaboration. For our part, you know, when we get truly antiquarian material, we work with Ken Carmiel over in Santa Monica. You know, David Brass is up in Thousand Oaks, and he specializes in fine bindings. Elizabeth Svensson of Walkabout Books does sort of travel and a lot of ephemera and interesting things. It's an eclectic group, but it's a very close-knit group. We managed to come together recently to support one of our own who was affected by the wildfires. And of course, we checked on all of our bookselling friends that were evacuated as well. So it's something of a family, a dysfunctional family, but a family nonetheless.
So where do you find the book dealers bumping into each other?
You know, we don't see a lot of each other in Los Angeles just because we are so spread out. I think we see each other when we visit, you know, visit each other's spaces or workspaces.
Right.
Yeah, you know, we're one of the last open shops here in Southern California, sadly. And so we get a lot of visits from colleagues. I have lunch with Ken Carmiel at least once a month as he makes his way from Santa Monica to Palm Springs. And we do, you know, having an open shop here, we open our doors for meetings and events. So we're sort of the gathering space. But beyond that, you know, we have annual bookseller dinners and things of that sort. And we might see each other at lectures at the Huntington, but it's on an irregular basis.
So you're actually supporting the Huntington Library with the tickets for the first night at Rare Books LA. That's correct, is it?
Yes. So all the proceeds from the opening night will go to the Huntington Library, which has been a great partner, not only with this fair, but with the ABAA fair when it is in town. And of course, the Huntington is one of the world's great institutions and regularly hosts lectures and exhibits and is a real cultural force here in Southern California.
So one thing I've noticed about your business that makes you a little different to the other antiquarian booksellers is that you have a specialism for books about heavy metal music, which I've not seen with any other dealers. I've seen counterculture, other types of rock and roll, but not heavy metal. So perhaps you can explain where that niche or that passion comes from.
This is entirely my fault. I grew up as a metalhead. It was the music of my teenage years. And one morning I was sitting over the breakfast table. A bookseller was staying with us. And I was complaining out loud how there was yet again another punk catalog, which punk material just seems ubiquitous. You can't go walk down an aisle of a book fair without seeing half a dozen items at least. But there just seemed to be no attention towards the heavy metal scene, which is, you know, approaching its 50th year and, you know, is truly an international genre of what I consider a working class music. So Jennifer and our friend sort of challenged me to do something about it, and together with Jennifer we formed this research collection, a sort of a seed collection on the history of heavy metal, which now is housed at UCLA, and it continues to be a specialty of ours and a sort of a way that I can bridge my vocation with my avocation.
So this material, would it be biographies of key figures within the scene, or is it things like concert posters, tickets, sheet music? Give me an idea of what all those items.
Our first collection had everything from a concert flyers, a pretty extensive collection of thousands of Sunset Strip concert flyers, original photographs of the band's suicidal tendencies in their infancy. It also had a lot of non-traditional materials like demo tapes and an actual denim battle jacket, you know, with studs and pins and patches. It was a pretty broad cross-section of material. There isn't a whole lot of material culture in the heavy metal scene, it being so working class. There's a little bit less of a tendency to create all the paper, like zines and things that you see in punk and elsewhere. But we tried to do and continue to try to gather really representative examples of metal throughout its history.
Yeah, if you walk into a mainstream bookstore, you're probably not going to see any biographies of heavy metal figures, maybe with the exception of Ozzy Osbourne. I can't think of any other ones who would get written up much.
They're out there, but they did not get published in near the same quantities as some more of mainstream artists. Yeah, it was really difficult. It took me quite a long time to track down a few of them. Arthur Brown, who is one of those seminal proto-metal figures, his biography is exceedingly difficult, but I managed to find one of those. And Alice Cooper had a biography in the early 70s,
which of course
was a difficult one to track down as well. But
so wasn't Arthur Brown the guy who sang Fire?
Exactly, the God of Hellfire.
Yeah, so somewhere in some book I read, I remember he was described as being completely crazy.
I actually had a chance to sit down with him 2 years ago at a concert festival in Las Vegas, and he was just an absolute pleasure and very, very kind and gracious. And he's really theatrically based and continues to be so. We were at this big festival with all these, young, aggressive metal kids, and he was actually playing his first concert in the United States in something like 35, 40 years. And I said, did you imagine that, back then, you were helping lay the groundwork for all of this? And he related this really fantastic story about how he was playing Hyde Park in, 72 or 73. Grand Funk Railroad showed up to play afterwards, and they're stacking amplifiers to the ceiling. And he said, at that point I thought my career was over. I was nothing but a footnote. And he said, and by and large, for the next 20, 30 years, I had a small but dedicated following, and I would play occasional shows, but I thought I was all but forgotten. He's going on tour again next year, or this year rather. Yeah, he's doing a little North American tour.
So who are customers of heavy metal books and ephemera? Are they grown-up metalheads?
A little bit, although I have to be honest, I think our focus has been to try to get this into academia. I really want to redress the balance. There's been too much attention in special collections libraries towards punk in particular, which is academically convenient but not as culturally relevant, in my opinion. But it's been metal's been sort of ignored at the same time. So we have worked really diligently to get metal materials placed in collections throughout the country, at Miami, at Cornell, smaller schools, UCLA, of course, USC, and so on. We do have several private clients, and they do tend to be those that probably grew up on, Judas Priest and Iron Maiden.
Right.
Yeah, but I think that tends to be the way with most collectors.
So perhaps one last question for you, Brad, before we pass over to Jen. Is there a heavy metal book or object that you crave to own but you've not yet found?
There was one piece that I don't think, who knows. We created this master list of things that we wanted to get and to put in our first seed collection, and it was one of those things that, that we could not track down, which was, there was this little pamphlet put out by this academic in Texas, and he was the guy who got the ear of Tipper Gore and sort of triggered the satanic panic of the 1980s, you know, in those hearings that led to the labeling of records and cassettes at the time. And it was basically one of those little tracks that spoke of the evils of heavy metal in particular, but also, you know, the hip hop of the time and other things. But it, you know, it was obviously a little self-published sort of thing. And try as we might, we could never track one of those down. You know, it was sort of the domino piece, the first domino in what became, you know, a big censorship battle.
Right, yeah. Right, okay. Oh, lovely, thank you. If you can pass over to Jen, we'll ask some questions about the bookshop. Welcome, Jen, thank you.
Thank you.
So, you have a bricks and mortar bookshop in Covina called The Bookshop, about 20 miles east of Los Angeles. Perhaps you can tell us a little about the shop and if it's true that you have a bookshop dog.
Yes, the bookshop is about 20 minutes east of Pasadena, depending on the day, because in Southern California you don't measure by miles, but what time of the day you're leaving to get anywhere. And you'll find that we have about 40,000 volumes on our shelves. Everything from, you know, a like nice secondhand paperbacks to classic vintage editions of some of the literary titles, Steinbeck, Gatsby. Actually, I should say that most of our shop is nonfiction. So we have a lot of people who come to see us who are looking for military history, ancient history, books about people, biographies, etc. We also have a huge following of people who just come to see our shop dog, Elkie. She's a German short-haired pointer, and she's very friendly. And if you come to the front counter, she'll pop up her head, and she'll give you kisses.
Fantastic. Does Elkie have a particular favorite genre?
No, she pretty much loves them all. She loves everything in the shop.
Fantastic.
She hasn't chewed up a book, thankfully.
That's good. That's good. So I've looked at some of your catalogues, and would it be fair to say that you're trying to expand beyond traditional antiquarian leather-bound books? But I see you offering things like vintage menus and period board games. So I thought that was something very interesting about your business.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we do think beyond. We actually think beyond just leather-bound books, and we think beyond actually the form of the book. We do a lot of work with special collections institutions, and they are looking for things that really kind of connect with students today. So when I think of the 1950s and 60s and even the 70s, I don't think it was that long ago, but for young people in college today who are really being pushed more into using original source material, those decades seem like they were so far in the past. So we're always looking to identify those types of materials, not just books, but menus, board games, pamphlets, letter collections, diaries, that help to define those social eras. And we did a project a couple of years ago because we were very intrigued by a board game we ran across that was about how to get out of prison. It was a board game about how do you get out of prison. That was the whole premise of the game. And it just seemed so curious to me that this game was created, and I thought, well, what other games are out there like that that have this underlying social commentary? And just struck upon just a plethora of games that were out there. And thinking about those games and thinking about how there's been so much research on game theory. So even the military invests, you know, millions of dollars, billions of dollars training the modern American soldier using game theory. And we indoctrinate our children to learn things using game theory. So if we're taking these games that have this social commentary about prisons, about what it means to be a young boy or a young girl, or what it means to be LGBTQ, what it means to have some certain political belief or to think about yourself in the context of a certain ethnic group through a game.
So when you say, sorry, Jen, when you say game theory, are you talking about the strategy it takes to win a game?
Well, it's the strategy that it takes to win a game, but also it's just the process of playing a game where you think you're part of just entertainment, but really the underlying effect is that you're learning something, but it's not conscious.
So in the same way that Monopoly can teach children about property ownership, rent, and budgeting.
Exactly. And I was thinking, because one of the games that I played a lot with my sisters and my brother growing up was the game of life.
Right.
It was very popular here in the United States when I was growing up. And it was this very traditional, you go around the board game, you decide whether or not you want to collect children and a house, or, you know, you want to take a different path. But for for my sister, who at the time didn't necessarily, but is a lesbian, she couldn't, adopt a wife. She
Right.
couldn't decide to have children. And so it made me think, what kind of unconscious, ideas did it put in her head about maybe how her thoughts and ideas don't conform with this traditional board game that we're playing.
So I guess when you're looking for a vintage board game, completeness must be very important to you.
It's funny because, I talk about it just like a book, collating it. So are all the parts there? And you hope that in the directions for the game that they tell you what the parts are, because they don't always.
Right, okay. And menus. So I also find menus very interesting. So perhaps you can explain, if you were to come across, a trove of menus from the 1950s, what you'd expect to tell those menus would tell us about that era.
Absolutely. So menus will tell us so many things. I mean, first of all, you can just look at them from a printing history point of view. So what kinds of materials were being used, what colors, what kind of graphic design schemes were being used. And then menus tell us, the locations of restaurants. So what were the popular dining districts in a community? They can also tell us what were the popular foods. So you might see new things that enter into menus. We always love looking at menus and seeing lists for drinks, because you'll see the heyday of gin and tonics or fizzies, or maybe the latest version of some other cocktail. They also help us understand price points. So you see, their menus, you might see that at the time a steak cost $1.50, but, a breast of chicken cost more. And that wouldn't be the case in today. So you look at how food preferences changed, and that comes through how you understand the cost through those. So there are so many data points on menus that are terrific. One of the things I love is there is a collector in San Francisco who collects menus that are from restaurants that were endorsed by Duncan Hines. And I always thought of Duncan Hines as the cake maker, like the mix that you get at the grocery store. But Duncan Hines was a real person, and he was a traveling salesman, and he actually had a guidebook that he put out for other traveling salesmen saying, these are Duncan Hines approved kind of road stop places to go where you can get a good square meal. And eventually it evolved into this kind of branding, if you will, to say, okay, this is the Duncan Hines seal of approval on this place. And they would place that kind of logo on their menus, and that they'd have decals in their windows.
So really they cover economics, almost agricultural production, design, I guess, all sorts of social issues from, a particular decade.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, they're fascinating.
Indeed. And I guess Hollywood restaurant menus, you always have the chance that you could find one that's signed by a famous guest.
Yes, of course. And, you know, whenever you find, like, in Southern California, in L.A., a Chasen's menu, you have to look to see who might have signed it, because every night of the week there was somebody famous there. And certainly, you know, if it was the big night out for Grandma and Grandpa, they would have walked over and asked one of those stars of the early centuries to sign it.
Of course, of course. So, as I mentioned earlier, yourself and Brad, you're a husband and wife book selling team. I do meet a few people, pairs such as yourselves. Perhaps you could explain how you met and how you started book selling.
Sure. Well, it's entirely Brad's fault. So we actually met working together on a political campaign. And during that time, we lost, and it was heartbreaking. And so I was working in public relations at the time, and Brad had taken a break actually from working at the bookshop to work on this political campaign. And so after after that was over, we were asked actually to work together on another political campaign, to run it for somebody who was running for Congress. And we decided to do that, knowing actually, oddly, that we were going to win. We were going to lose that campaign too, but it was one of those you have to run. And we just really worked well together. And then we really liked each other, and then we really loved each other. And after that was over, we went to visit the owner of the shop where he worked, the bookshop. And he was deciding to retire, and so we said, hey, let's buy it, and the rest is history.
And that is the bookshop in Covina.
That is the bookshop in Covina. That's us. So, you know, since we bought the shop, things have changed a lot, not just with our business, but also in the book trade in general. You know, we have expanded the bookshop beyond just the brick and mortar that we have, and really gone into more specializing in archival materials and doing more in the trade, like promoting Rare Books LA and being involved in the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America. So our universe has expanded much farther beyond just the bricks and mortar walls that we have here at the bookshop.
So the word archives in your business name is crucial now. That's one of the directions you're going.
Yes. Yeah, it is very crucial. I mean, we deal in archival material all the time. You'll see that at book fairs. We're trying to figure out the best ways for that also to translate online to through the services that we sell through, like Abe Books. I think even Abe Books itself is trying to get a better grasp and understanding about how best to present those materials and present them so that people can search for them and find them online, which is, it's not as easy. I mean, this isn't like, you don't have 500 copies of one particular archive. It's one of one. So, and archives are fascinating. I learn something new every single day in my job working with archival material that we represent.
So normally when you're building an archive, do you look to pick up a single person's letters and materials, or are you trying to put something custom together from multiple sources?
That's a really good question. We actually approach it both ways. So oftentimes we'll pick up collections, and we really don't specialize necessarily in collections that are from obvious famous people. So a lot of the collections that we pick up and that we're interpreting and presenting as things that need to be preserved have to do with everyday people. So we have offered and sold many collections of letters from people who were in military. Like World War II letters are very popular.
Yes.
Because they tell so much information. Anytime any information could get through in those letters, because they were so heavily censored, that's kind of, you know, you kind of celebrate those moments, because yes. The censors were really very good. And I specialize in actually reading a lot of diaries, particularly about women. So you just have to deep dive and.
Yes, I see the same demand for personal photograph albums of soldiers from both world wars, because they were taking images sometimes that were prohibited, and then they're not the official photographs, and they're behind the lines. I see a lot of demand for that sort of thing.
Exactly. I mean, and these are things that have been just kind of in people's personal collections, their personal archives, but now we're getting a couple generations removed. People might not have connections with great-great-grandpa and appreciate it. So a lot of this stuff is ending up at estate sales or flea markets, and they could be lost to history. We do our best to make sure that, you know, letters don't get just sold off one by one to get a nice ribbon tied around them to look really cute in a basket, because they have so much more importance staying together to tell the entire story of that person's experience as part of history.
Okay. Back to your bookshop, and sort of back to heavy metal in a sort of way. Am I right in saying there's a sort of very faint link between your bookshop or the town you're in and Wayne's World?
Yeah. I don't know the history very well. Brad actually, I'll tell you what Brad has told me. So yes, Wayne's World was filmed in downtown Covina. And in fact, as we speak, down the street, they are filming an episode of My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So
right.
We're a very popular little town because we're very quaint and not overly touched by too much modernization. But the two characters in Wayne's World were driving down Citrus. It's the Great Poupon scene, I'm told. The Great Poupon scene, where... yeah, Brad's going to have to tell it. I can tell you another movie story, though.
Go on, then.
Okay. So you probably don't know that I am a professional actress.
I do not know that.
I'm not really, but... the movie Annabelle, which is the prequel to The Conjuring, was filmed at the bookshop.
Right.
And so when they were setting up the filming, one of the producers, directors said, well, oh, we need another extra. We need a shop assistant. And I stepped out of the stacks and said, oh, I'll do that. And he said, oh, sure, why not? You know, hey, it's her shop. We should probably let her do what she wants. And so I turned to Brad and he's like, sure, fine, go. So they whisked me off to the Star Wagon and put me in costume. And I am in two scenes of the movie Annabelle, which was shot here in our store. And I'm playing my real life character, which is a store clerk.
That's good. I figured that if everyone hangs around long enough and keep your eyes open, we all have a chance to be in a movie one time or another.
Exactly. I can tell you that I won't ever have that dream again, because it was just a lot of standing around and waiting for things to happen.
Yes, I used to live in Oxford, and they were filming the Inspector Morse series. And I was in the Covered Market one day, and there was the two main actors standing in front of me waiting for a scene to start, and they were directing people just walking around, saying, if you hang around long enough, you can be in the back scene, in the back of the scene. And I waited 20 minutes and then thought, this is terrible, nothing's going to happen here, and I just walked off in the end. It was too long a wait.
Right. I understand. Yeah.
Yes. All right, one final question for you. And I ask this to all the guests, but what book are you reading at the moment?
Oh, well, so I'd like to talk about myself as a mood reader. So I don't have just one book going. I always have multiples, because I never know at the end of the day, which is when I read, how I'm going to feel about reading that evening. So I have a couple of things going. I just finished reading Play It As It Lays, and I'm also currently reading The Blind Assassin.
The Blind Assassin. I have that one.
The Blind Assassin. You know, we haven't had a chance to talk to you about an exciting thing that we're bringing to Rare Books LA.
Go on then, you tell me.
Okay. Well, so we are representing at Rare Books LA the library of Hugh Hefner.
Okay. So I can remember reading some article where he had a very good library, I believe, and was well into books.
Yes. Well, as the publisher of Playboy, you know, there's the old joke is, oh, I get it for the articles. Well, in fact, there was quite a bit of fine writing that, you know, was part of the pages of Playboy. You know, he had a lot of respected writers who wrote.
I think people like Atwood and Updike wrote for him. Yeah.
Exactly. And Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas was, or not Fear and Loathing, The Shark Hunt was serialized in Playboy. One of the things that we're most excited about that we're bringing to Rare Books LA is a copy of Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service by Ian Fleming. And it's an inscribed copy from Ian Fleming to Hugh Hefner.
Oh.
Yeah, it's quite a treasure.
So what else is in the Hefner Library? I'm quite interested in that.
Yeah, there are quite a few inscribed books that are pretty exciting. There is a book about Betty Page, and that book is inscribed by her to Hugh Hefner, thanking him for all the support that she gave to him. There is a wonderful book about Bunny Yeager by Bunny Yeager, and she again is inscribed that book to Hugh Hefner, and she of course was, you know, really responsible for helping to kind of promote the way in which a lot of the photography moved forward in magazines.
So Bunny Yeager was a pinup model, I seem to remember.
Yeah, but more famously a photographer.
Yeah. Changed career halfway through. I remember now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I'm sure it'll be a treat for whoever comes up to your booth at the book fair.
Yes, absolutely.
All right,
and,
lovely.
There's one more exciting collection that we're not responsible for that is coming to Rare Books LA that I think is just tremendous. We have two booksellers who've been working together for literally the past 3 years, pulling together this wonderful collection of material about the national parks in the United States.
Right.
And the title of their catalog is Our National Parks. It's over 125 pages. They have items that represent every single national park within the U.S. park system. And that was produced by Elizabeth Svensson from Walkabout Books. And Andy Nettle from Back of Beyond Books in Moab.
Okay, lovely. Well, it sounds like there's going to be an awful lot for people to see at Rare Books LA.
Yes.
So we'll wrap up now then, Jen.
Great.
So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. I want to say a big, huge thank you to Brad and Jen Johnson for joining us. Good luck with the book fair. So if you care to visit Rare Books LA, then it is at the Pasadena Convention Center on Friday, 1st of February, from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m., and then also on Saturday, February the 2nd, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. A ticket costs $20 on the Friday, which is good for both days, and proceeds go to benefit the Huntington Library. And tickets will cost $10 on the Saturday. And you can find out more details at the fair's website, which is rarebooksla.com, rarebooksla.com. And that is it. Thank you for listening. My name is Richard Davis from Abe Books, and we will see you next time. Thank you very much.